So I serve as the clinical director at the Institute for Human-Animal Connection, and Dr. Ashione is our executive director. And most of the time I get to work on the positive side of the human-animal connection, where I'm working with graduate students to include animals in a really wide array of human health outcomes. And now we're doing more work on animal abuse. I can't entirely blame that on Frank either, because we know that animal abuse existed before Dr. Ashione moved to Colorado. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about this. But before I do that, let me just tell you a little bit about our program here. I know we're not supposed to sell anything, but I got to tell you a little bit about what we do at the University of Denver. We have been heavily involved in developing an institute that is beginning to research the benefits of the human-animal connection. And in doing that, there's obviously a dark side to the human-animal bond. But we have an excellent program there and a very supportive. That's our dean, James Herbert Williams, at the National Institute for Health's meeting earlier this year. And as part of this, we have students who are able to train therapy dogs and graduate as therapists. And they train their therapy dogs through their second year in graduate school. This is one of our students who is working with high-risk youth. We have two courses. And these two academic courses allow students then to have a secondary specialization along with a master's degree in social work at the end of their graduation. We also have a distance learning curriculum that allows students to take this program from really anywhere in the world. And I think we've had maybe five or six countries represented now from around the world, and our instructors actually teach from all over the place as well. So we're talking a lot about the human-animal connection. And and there's a reason to start this presentation. In fact, probably an equally important panel we could have organized for this conference really could have focused probably on a more important element, which is that most of our contact with companion animals in the United States, and we have a really high prevalence of animals, of all different varieties, that most of the times those interactions go very well. This little graph here would suggest, almost half of people call them members of their family. A large number think of them as close acquaintances. The biggest, really for all practical purposes, it wouldn't surprise me if the biggest public health initiative anywhere in the United States are our companion animals, potentially. If it's going well, right? This kind of represents prevention opportunity, right? And so one of the things that we might put on the agenda for next year, instead of talking about just abuse, is talk about what do we need to know about keeping companion animals, and how could we go about institutionalizing humane education, proper care of animals, because increasingly the data is starting to support that this is where we're going to get early prevention and not only stop animal abuse, but stop, or at least intervene as early as possible in a lot of the other callous and high-risk traits of youth coming up. And where we find kids, we find animals in the United States for the most part. I mean, they go hand in hand wherever you go. So. Because this is our abuse right here, right? So we could wait until we're dealing with abuse, and I think we need to address that, but we need to be increasingly interested in the broader issue of what are we doing with our companion animals every day. So this is the way we've talked about the link. So we referred to it as the link for many years. It's a registered trademark now of the American Humane Association. And increasingly, we're starting to see not only the issues related to domestic violence, but also child maltreatment and elder maltreatment. I won't go into that a lot because I think Frank will talk a little bit about that. I'm not going to talk about this either because this is Dr. Ashione's definition, but I told you it's good to plagiarize somebody before they get to it. So let's just talk about maybe an example for how this presents itself. Let's talk about it in relation to child maltreatment. The study that was done, whoops, this is a little sensitive here, I don't know what's going on with my font. It's all over the place here. But In any case, this was a study done by the MSPCA a number of years ago, but it was an important study because what it showed us by reviewing records and just using existing records was that they were able to identify that families that were known to have high-risk cases in child maltreatment were already generally known by animal control and vice versa. So that these were, in many cases, indicators that signaled problems in these particular family systems. I apologize for these graphics being all over the place. It must be the difference between my computer and this one. The Apple computer phenomenon. Yeah, I know everyone always says that, but, you know, anyways. So this says bite rate was 11 times greater in these homes. So why would that be? Well, we're in family violence. We see all different kinds of individuals trying to defend themselves against the pathology and violence and abuse going on in that home. Animals are just one more example of that. So for the last 2 years, I've been working on a project that we refer to as the Colorado Link Project. It's a two-year funded project by a foundation here in Colorado called the Animal Assistance Foundation, which has been a great friend of our institute in many ways. And what our goal in this particular study was to really try to understand what was happening in animal abuse cases from the inception of the report to the disposition of those cases. So we spent the first year gathering cases. We've looked at a lot of cases over the last year. In Colorado is a big state. We have dozens of counties or dozens of judicial districts, for example. We have hundreds of law enforcement agencies. Animal abuse gets reported differently in all different corners of the state. So it's been a challenge. But we've looked at a lot of very interesting findings. And some of the things that we think are quite important, one of which is we have multiple disciplines that encounter animal abuse in the course from inception of the report to disposition. Not just law enforcement, not just animal control, not just prosecutors. Many, many different individuals are involved. And the breakdown in how we handle those cases happen differently with these different disciplines. We also found that these different disciplines have very random standards, very random training. Really divergent guidelines for how they go about handling these cases, and they're really not institutionalized in their practices at all. So we don't have any kind of formidable document that any one individual, even profession, would look at for the most part that provides a comprehensive document for how Colorado should go about addressing these cases. And lastly, the prevalence of abuse is quite common. If we look at just the felony cases in Colorado, you would probably come away thinking Colorado has very few serious animal abuse cases, which is not true. There's literally thousands of animal abuse cases. Only a handful elevate to the level of felony cases. And as a result, the cases are filed differently, the information is stored in a different database, and it's very difficult to get a good sense of what's going on in the case. So we have a lot of work around coordination that needs to occur. The other thing that I don't have on this list that we found, however, is that Colorado is well suited to be a model state in many regards. We have the necessary legislation to do many of the things that Diane was just talking about, that we could be much more comprehensive in the way we're handling these cases, and it's not the law that's preventing us from doing it, it's really our own standards. These are examples of some of the varieties of professionals that are going to encounter these cases along the journey from beginning to end. You can probably imagine all of these. I'll just give you an example of one that we might not commonly think about, would be public education and school counseling. There's reason to believe that some of the most prevalent animal deaths are occurring on the windowsill of the public high school because we have an animal that's not properly cared for, and it dies just in the process of not really being well cared for in that circumstance. That's not a psychopathic or abusive individual intentionally, but it is a problem in part because what it's teaching the kids in that public school environment. Okay, so we have a lot of different individuals involved in these situations. One of the things that we'll just use as an example is that part of our task or our goal in the Colorado, in this particular project, is to help the professionals find the right instruments to make competent decisions. And one of the things that we're finding, and I think Diane was kind of getting at this with law enforcement or animal control, they may be a bit paralyzed, not being sure what are the right tools to use to make a decision. When we talk about domestic violence and mandatory arrests, you know, we used to, prior to that kind of policy being enacted, law enforcement officers regularly encountered domestic violence where they had to try to problem solve and figure out what was going on in a family violence scene, and they really didn't have the instruments and tools or competency to always do that. That policy helped them begin to have a strategy for handling this. What we're finding is that most animal abuse cases are really struggling right at this stage where the investigation is not occurring thoroughly. They don't know whether they're looking at a very serious case or not. They don't always know if it's attached to link violence and that sort of thing. So one of the projects, one of the outcomes of the project, and I'll encourage you to go visit our institute's website, the Institute for HumanAnimalConnection.org. There will be a link off of that later this year to the Colorado, to this particular project, to the Colorado Link Project. The Link Project will then be developing the specific toolkits for each of these different disciplines. So these are just examples of decision of groups that need these decision-making tools in order for us to move forward. Why is that important? I think Diane already got to this, so I'm not going to spend much time on this. But you can imagine if we're dealing with this range of violence, we're dealing with a wide range of potential cases. We're dealing with companion animals in some cases, and farm animals in others, and even wildlife cases. And in some cases, even the animal behavior issues that we think we know aren't always clear cut. I was just down in Colorado Springs earlier this year, and was interacting with a puppy, a pit bull puppy, that had its arms duct taped together, lowered into a dog crate that was put into a bathtub, and then filled so that it was kind of a pseudo-drowning, which the offender was using to terrorize his family. And so his goal was to terrorize his children and his wife. After that, he threw the dog down the hall, broke one of its arms, and this dog had, you know, a noticeably misshaped arm, but his behavior didn't show a dog that was particularly afraid. So even if we have to even be careful a little bit of assumptions that we might make, that if we go into house and we have abuse going on, we're going to see an animal that looks afraid. Not all the time. Just like human victims don't always present the same way every time. So we have a wide range of presentations that we have to be prepared to encounter. This is our attempt to try to define a flow chart. And as you can see, here's where the case comes in. We have a number of cases that are not responded to. Probably our biggest our informing agent in animal abuse cases is the community at large. They are usually the persons reporting these cases, a neighbor, somebody who's just upset at how that animal is being treated. How am I doing? 3 minutes. Okay, I'm okay. But I can get 3 minutes from Frank's presentation because Diane got 3 minutes of mine. Here's where we also see what we were just talking about. Animal control law enforcement, if they aren't sure what they're looking at, in many cases it's an unfounded case. So what gets it into a criminal filing and what gets it into these situations where an attorney, a district attorney or prosecuting attorney actually screens the case? We had a case up in Boulder this year where a woman duct taped her boyfriend's puppy to the refrigerator, which happened in the end to kill the puppy, suffocated. And that particular case was prosecuted initially as a misdemeanor, so she wasn't eligible to be prosecuted as a felony case. Now Boulder, as a result of that case, has asked for one of their attorneys to screen every animal abuse case to see whether it really belongs in a misdemeanor or felony abuse filing category. You know, so even kind of structural changes in how we deal with these at each stage will be a tremendous benefit. So this is, let's just look at this for a second. Now let's imagine that you're going to this house as a child protection worker, and you're coming in through the front door of this house, and you're going to investigate the condition of the children in that home. Would it interest you if this is what was going on in the backyard? And why would it interest us? Well, it might interest us because this looks like there's some potential neglect going on. From an animal control standpoint, somebody could argue that this animal has shelter, can crouch underneath the table, it might have water in that bucket, and it might not be confiscatable under animal cruelty. If you were an animal control officer and you're coming in through the back gate and you're going to check out the condition of this animal, we want our animal control officers to be wondering what the condition of the children in that house are, right? So these should inform our individual practices, because if we have a neglected animal that ultimately ends up looking like this, we have to wonder what's going to happen to the children in that household. We have started in an effort to do this, we've started to begin looking at typologies of animal abusers. So there's always difficulty when we're developing forensic typologies. It's easy to over-pathologize, and in many cases, labeling doesn't always help us do better work. But in some cases, it does. These are distinct, different types of animal cruelty cases that we think look different, not only in, you know, kind of on every level of our investigation of these cases. These, on this side, are diagnostic categories that also have treatment planning implications, dispositional implications, and the example that I have consistently used, since I know I need to be really fast here, is you can't consequence, you know, a bipolar disorder out of somebody, right? You can't do that, right? So if somebody is engaging in animal abuse because they have a severe mental illness, we want them to be referred to the court with a clear understanding of that. We need a good assessment of that individual. We want our prosecutor to ask for required mental health care, and we want them on first name basis with their psychiatrist. If they're a domestic violence offender or psychopathic individual or what have you, we really want them on probation and on first name basis with their probation officer and their judge, right? So we have very distinct categories of offenders that will come out of this. So lastly, we also need differences along a treatment continuum for intervention. We have a lot of programs that are doing humane education now. That's great for a low-level offender whose offense is largely based out of lack of understanding or lack of concern or proper education about animals, but it's not going to solve the problem when we have, let's say, a highly antisocial client who really needs to be spending time, you know, in prison probably. And we need the whole range of continuum in order to support the court's effectiveness with animal abuse. So that's about it. But I completely agree that this is a public health and a public safety issue. And I'll just reiterate one more time, the proper care of animals is also an opportunity for public health as well. Thanks. Thank you.